Steve Barkley Ponders Out Loud is brought to you by Academy for Educators, online professional development for teachers and leaders, online courses, modules, and micro-credential programs for teachers to enhance their skill sets. Now featuring the instructional coaching micro-credential, including 5 online modules framed around the work of Steve Barkley. Learn, grow, inspire. AcademyForEducators.org.
Hello, and welcome to the Steve Barkley Ponders Out Loud podcast. For the last 35 years, I've had the opportunity to learn with educators at all levels, both nationally and internationally. In each of the coming episodes, I'll explore my thoughts and my learning on a variety of topics connected to teaching, learning, and leading. Thanks for listening in.
A conversation with Jim Knight. I'm excited today on this podcast to have a conversation with a longtime colleague and a co-worker in the field of coaching, Jim Knight. Welcome, Jim.
Hey, it's so good to see you again, Steve, and hear your voice. I'm as you recall, when I was writing instructional coaching, your book looked like it had been read 20 times over, had a million post-it notes all over it and highlighted it. Your book really helped us lay the groundwork for what we do. And then we've been able to partner, not near enough, but frequently over the last few years. So it's great to see you. Way back when we were on that School Improvement Network.
Yeah.
In a series about coaching.
Yeah.
I looked thinner and younger back then, though.
but you got a lot more knowledge about coaching now, like I do, right? lots of miles, right?
Yeah. Back then there was no books written. So we've written quite a few since then.
So I'm going to be joining Jim at a conference in October, and we thought we'd have a little connect before then. So where do you think's best for us to start, Jim?
I can just dive right in with the questions. And
go ahead.
All right. So the first question is, how did you come to write about coaching?
Well, it only took me 25 years. When you read in my first book, Quality Teaching and a Culture of Coaching, I entered the teaching field under a coaching model. So my student teaching was done in a classroom with a master teacher at the university and another student teacher and a graduate assistant and visiting professors. And I spent a whole year basically being observed and getting coaching feedback every day. And I left there and went into a teaching that was always done on a team. So while coaching wasn't formal, it had always been informal. And I wasn't until I got out working in professional development that I realized very few teachers had had that experience. And I began trying to create it, first through a peer coaching model, later looking at mentoring as a form of coaching, looking at how administrators coach. And then as the instructional coaching position emerged, I moved over to that. But it took me 25 years from the time I started working in it till I actually got that first book done.
That's very cool. Well, and the rest is history. Why don't you just tell us about the books you have written? We've got quite a few books. The Coaching Culture book was the first one that I experienced, but then you've got instructional coaching book. So anyway, why don't you tell us about your publications?
Well, instructional coaching with the end in mind is the other book I have that that focuses on coaching. And I wrote that as I began to differentiate people who were in the position of an official instructional coach from what I had been working on in peer coaching. And also it's when I really got into spending more of my coaching looking at student behavior than at teacher behavior. And so that whole backwards planning part came out in that book, Instructional Coaching with the End in Mind. The other writing that I've published, actually more on coaching, is found in my blogs than in the books. I've got a book on tapping student effort, increasing student achievement. One called Wow, Adding Pizzazz to Teaching and Learning, and another on Questions for Life. The Questions for Life book has a connection to how people use similar critical thinking processes in coaching that a teacher would be using in their classroom. Jim, why don't you do a quick run through of your books too? Because we got lots of people out there that are go back and forth between our writing.
Sure. We didn't really start out wanting to study coaching. We just saw that professional development wasn't working. I had used learning strategies for young adults with learning disabilities in Toronto, developed at the University of Kansas. And they really worked great. And I wanted people to get them. I became a professional developer and nothing was happening. Nobody was implementing. So at that time, Michael Pollan was at University of Toronto. I studied with him in a couple courses and he kind of mentored me. And I took his ideas and I said, well, how can we put this into practice? And then we created these positions called learning consultants. And then we wrote a Gear Up grant for quite a bit of money to help us study it, change in middle schools and high schools. In that grant, we referred to people as instructional collaborators. And I wrote an article for Journal of Staff Development about instructional collaborators and what they did. When it came back, I thought, when they accepted it, it was my first sort of article ever really accepted. And when they accepted it, I got it back and I thought, I'm going to change the name from instructional collaborator to instructional coach. And I sent it back in. And we kind of felt for a few years that we had invented the term instructional coach, kind of like Al Gore and the internet. But really, it's been around since the 90s. There's an article from like 1993 talking about instructional coaching in Army schools, I think. So it's been around. But then I wrote a book, Instructional Coaching, which kind of captured what we learned in the first 10 years of our work looking at this role. And then I wrote a book called Unmistakable Impact, which is really taking a core idea for us, this idea of positioning the teacher as a partner and saying, how does that inform how teams work and how school-wide change works and how workshops are led and how we do coaching, and explored that and what's the communication that makes that happen. And then I had a book called High Impact Instruction, which is a quick summary of our teaching practices. We use it as a model for what I call an instructional playbook. Focus on Teaching came out in 2014, which is about using video as a part of professional development. And it looks at it for teacher evaluation, for teams, for self-coaching, but also especially for instructional coaching. And then 2015 was Better Conversations, a book about some core communication habits and also about using video to get better at the way you communicate. So people could record conversations with their kids or their spouse or the people they're coaching or sitting in meetings, and there's a bunch of tools for analyzing them. And then most recently, the Impact Cycle talks about our research on the coaching cycle we follow, and it's packed with resources. Most of them are online, though, so you don't have to really necessarily buy the book, but go to instructionalcoaching.com and click on the resources section. All those books have tons of free resources, and they can get them, a lot of videos and stuff like that. But that's kind of it. Sort of said, well, we need to use video. We need to know how to communicate. We need to have some teaching practices to work from. We need a cycle to work from. We need a philosophical theory behind what we do, which is the Unmistakable Impact book. And you know, like you, we're just trying to move forward, trying to solve a problem. And the problem is, I don't even joke about solving a problem, but we're trying to get better at what we do. We're trying to have the best possible instruction we can and keep doing new stuff, trying to figure out how to do it. Next book is on gathering data in the classroom. So that's what I'm writing with another author, Michael Fajella-Luby, who's a researcher at TCU.
Jim, a focus that I've been digging deeper into lately, I'm calling the culture of coaching. Right. And I'm recognizing that if we're going to get the impact on student learning, that people in leadership positions, where I strongly place instructional coaches working with administrators and teacher leaders in their schools, have got to move us toward a culture of coaching where the role of the instructional coach becomes one of coaching. In other words, they kind of take the lead and do the demonstration and provide the support that moves towards all the teachers in the school engaging in peer coaching, because I don't see that we can get enough coaching happening in the building if it's only occurring by instructional coaches. I'm just wondering what your thoughts would be there.
Well, I think there are different roles. You know, there's instructional coach and there's peer coach. And, you know, I distinguish between facilitative coaching and dialogical coaching and directive coaching. And for me, facilitative coach, most coaching fits in that category. And facilitative coaching is where the coach sets their expertise aside and they use effective questioning and listening and a process to help the person think deeply about what they do, but they don't necessarily have a deep knowledge of what the research says about effective instruction. They have what their life experiences show them, which is indeed a deep knowledge, but they don't know the literature and they don't know, well, in this situation, this is what you, I mean, they could, and it'd be great if they did, but they have been teaching, they haven't invested their time in learning what's the literature say about you. And to me, an instructional coach is the person who has that knowledge, but shares it in a way that's dialogical. So always positioning the teacher as a decision maker. And I think there are going to be times when you don't need an instructional coach, because indeed the coach can solve their own problems, and through reflection and conversation, they're going to surface things. And if you bring teachers together to coach each other, they probably need a facilitative approach. They probably need to step away from set their expertise aside. But I think it's also helpful to have a person who's like a curator of research on instruction, and they help people learn that. Now, people will say, well, we can't afford that. But I think they still have athletic coaches. And, you know, if you sit down and you actually look at the budget and where all the money is going, to have one person whose job is to be, here's how I'm going to help you take the research on instruction and help you operationalize it and turn it into practice and to help shape a culture from a culture of talk to a culture of action. I think, to me, that's a crazy investment not to make. That person has to know what they're doing. And so they have different roles. I mean, I think you could use a facilitative approach. We take your idea of a culture of change. My friend Christian Van Neuerberger is really interested in coaching students and teaching students how to coach each other. And so that there is this sense of we are all involved in a process of continuous improvement. And I think it's, if you have a culture of inertia, it's going to be hard. You're going to have to fight against the current the whole time just to get one coaching cycle going, because everything's kind of conspiring against you. So I really think your emphasis on culture is very important.
Well, I see the two pieces fitting together. Right. So that instructional coach who has that expertise to get us implementing and focused on the desired teacher actions and behaviors, and then the ability for staff within a school to coach each other, raising the consciousness and increasing the likelihood that people can implement long-term what the instructional coach helped them find out.
Right. The one thing I'd add is that for us, the coaching is goal-driven. And it's a teacher sets a goal. And let's say they look at a video of their lesson and they go, man, I wasted 25 minutes at the start of the class. Or there's not a level of engagement I want to see. The kids just don't seem that keen. Or they set in a process to look at student achievement. They pretest, post-test, they look at achievement, and the kids aren't learning the content. Once we've got the goal, then we start to share the teaching practices. But we don't show up and say, you really need to do gradual release, and this is the way research has said, and I'm going to make sure you do it. We let the teacher set the goal, and we start with the teacher goal. And I think that would be probably the same with your more peer coaching kind of approach. And you're absolutely right. The two are not mutually exclusive. Why couldn't we do both at the same time? Or sometimes one's more appropriate than another. You know?
Well, I'll give you another place that links together for me. A lot of the instructional coaches that I work with are tied heavily into the professional learning communities that are operating within their schools. So I'm big goal driven from the professional learning community. So that professional learning community sets a goal as to something they want to make happen with student learning that hasn't been happening. And as they work on that goal in the backwards plan, they're identifying what I started calling student production behaviors. What would students have to do in order for students to reach the goal? And, right. And then stepping back to say, okay, what's the teacher's role now in engaging students in those student production behaviors? And that's where I see the instructional coach being able to step in with some expertise to assist people in identifying what those strategies, what those teacher behaviors are. And then the opportunity for people within that PLC to provide each other with peer coaching as they work to implement those strategies. Again, coming back to that goal-driven piece.
The one thing I would say about PLCs is I think it's very important that we don't have the coach's job be to take care of all the issues that haven't been fully addressed through professional development and professional learning. So sometimes what I'll see is that the coach is on the PLC, but really the reason the coach has been asked to be on the PLC is just to make sure the teachers are not just complaining. The PLC doesn't have a successful process in place, and the coach is just kind of babysitting, which is you're putting a Band-Aid on this issue, and really what you really need is what you could probably help people learn is a process for how the PLC can function effectively. And, you know, a coach could help people learn that. That's their area of focus. But the same thing, sometimes people will say, well, the coaches have to do the walkthrough because the principals will never do the walkthrough. The principals aren't really instructional leaders. The coach needs to take over that role. Well, that's not the solution. The solution is not to have the coach be a Band-Aid for a problem. The issue is to build those capacities on PLCs and in leadership in the school and so forth. The coach can't be our fix-it yep. person. The coach needs to actually coach. That's the way I would
say. I'm actually working with several systems on extracting the coach from the PLC. We're talking about the coach being invited to a PLC when the PLC is at the point that they need the coach's expertise.
Perfect.
Not the coach being the ongoing facilitator of the PLC because the system didn't invest in preparing the teachers for how to work as a professional learning community.
Right. I'm with you 100%. And I would add to it, you know, that if that coach is there, that's half their day gone. If they're at every PLC, you know, 50% of their time, close to at any rate, is spent just sitting in a meeting that they might not have any capacity to provide support. But to bring them in when it's appropriate, I'm with you all the way. I totally agree.
And you've really labeled it. One of the things I have people looking at is how much of the coach's day is actually allotted to them working in a coaching relationship with a teacher. And in some places it can get pretty small.
Like less than 10%.
Yeah.
It's astonishing. And frequently less than 50%, like the majority, I would say.
It's easy to get to this tendency of who can we look to take care of this? And the instructional coach appears as somebody with flexibility in their schedule that can be thrown at the problem.
So I got a couple other questions here. And the next one is, what are some of your core ideas in your approach to coaching? Do you want to add to that from what you said? You've already given me a lot of good stuff.
Yeah, a biggie is that backwards planning process that causes the teacher being coached to recognize the impact of his or her changes by observing the student response. So this is the teacher behavior that I'm working on changing, and I know that I'm being successful with changing it because I'm seeing a change in the student learning production behavior. And that's important to me because that behavior precedes the student actually reaching the outcome. So I know the student's going to become a better writer because I see the student engaged in these writing production behaviors. And that's how I know the behaviors that I took on as a teacher got the student engaged in that. So similar that if a coach goes in and models a lesson for a teacher, I encourage in that first modeling, the teacher's paying most attention to the kids and how the kids are responding to the coach. And then when the teacher says, yeah, that's what I want to get the kids to do, now go back and look at the model and now be paying close attention to the coach, because that's the piece that you're going to do. And you'll know that you're doing it successfully when you see that you're getting the response from the students that the coach got when she did the modeling.
Yeah, you know, there's people who don't like modeling as a part of coaching. And our argument I've heard is because it makes it look like we're the good teacher and you just need to watch us. But what I've seen when there's modeling is it actually, as Edgar Schein says, it equilibrates the conversation. It makes it more equal because it's not going to be perfect. I mean, if you go in and spend 5 hours preparing and you bring in some super duper show, I don't think it's that productive. I think you should take about the amount of planning time the teacher would have and give them a fair bit. And we wouldn't probably teach the whole lesson. We'd just teach a part of it. But then we sit down and we talk about it, and it's really just two people talking about what happened. It's not like, oh, you're awesome and I'm not. The other thing about modeling that I like is when I model, I have a whole different understanding of the class than when I observe the class. When you stand in front of the kids, when you start to teach, you go, oh, this is what she was talking about. And you don't really get it in the same way until you ask a question and it's just like kaplunk. There's just, you know, it's just dead. So there's a lot of, to me, modeling doesn't seem inequitable at all. So long as there's a real sense in which I'm just trying this out, then we'll talk about it. We'll see how it goes. You try it out. We'll see how it goes.
So I like to add this: whenever possible, if the coach can actually do the planning with the teacher, so that the teacher can listen in on the coach's planning, so that the teacher knows what the coach is expecting to have happen. And then when it happens or doesn't happen, then the coach is in a good spot to talk about what decisions did the coach make during the lesson that were different. I've had the opportunity to coach coaches while they're modeling. And it's really been interesting conversations when I make it easy for the coach to talk about how she changed her thinking in the middle of it. And it would be awful for the person who she was modeling for to miss that. So the more that can be a dialogue as you've described it, I think the more the other person can learn from it rather than being a show.
Yeah, I like it. My next question is, what distinguishes your work from other people's work on coaching? And you may have already answered that question too, but I'm just putting it out there.
Jim, I think the biggest thing that I've focused on is I really like everybody's model. and I think to some extent, I've stayed shy of a model, so that if you look at my work with questioning, my work with conferencing, how you hold the conference with the teacher, taking a look at how you engage the teacher in the thinking process with you, I think you can use that in various models. So, you know, I talk about a more technical approach versus a more cognitive approach. I wrote an article on the different descriptors that you've used in the way that you write about it. And I think it's a matter of the coach being able to develop the skills to step in and out of the models, with the big goal being the ability of the coach to figure out the best way to work with the person you're working with.
Right. I couldn't agree more. What would you say have been some of your key learnings over the past few years?
Well, definitely that big learning for me was paying much more attention to the students. So I described to people, if you had worked with me 25 years ago, I was going in and observing teachers, watching what the teacher was doing and giving the teacher feedback on what the teacher did. And now the largest majority of my time is watching kids and engaging the teacher in the conversation of where did the teacher see and hear what she wanted to in order to cause the student learning, and where would she want to get a change in what it was that the kids were doing, and then coming back to look at the teaching strategies that would assist the teacher in getting that change. And I also think along that same line then is making that more personalized to the different student audiences that are in the same class at the same time.
Yeah, I think the advantage of the student change we've seen is teachers are more likely to implement the thing if they see a change in kids than if they just try out a strategy. And also what we call a student-focused school is an external standard for excellence. So we say, I want my kids to be able to write a well-organized paragraph using this checklist. And we have to keep going until we hit the goal. But if we say, I want to use more technology, we can use technology a few times and say, there, we hit the goal. Whether it worked or not, or whether it was effective or not. But so I think yeah. It's more compelling for the teacher. And there's and I don't have to be the fidelity police. I don't have to be the one who makes sure they do it the right way. I just have to say, well, let's see if we can hit the goal. You know, you want to change it? Let's try it out. So I think the student focus role is a critical part of it. In fact, I'm increasingly convinced we need to interview students. We need to involve students in gathering data. We need to make kids a part of the coaching. You know, if it's truly student focused, then the kids should be able to talk about the relevance of the learning and their perspective on it, and they should talk about the culture of the classroom, all those things, you know.
And if we move further down the road to personalize, I can't personalize without the student's input, without the student's sense of empowerment. Right. So in effect, moving the teachers towards making more of their decisions based on the feedback and the input they get from the students.
So this next question might be one you'll want to think about, but it's the question is, what's a good metaphor for what coaches do?
Yep, I don't know. I'm kind of going the other direction, that coaching is a good metaphor for what teachers need to be doing.
Oh, that's good. I think that's fine.
If you were to look back at the classroom, I think we need to move more and more towards the teacher being a coach of the student. So getting the student to set a goal that they want to achieve, to figure out what behaviors they need as a student to achieve that goal, and then assist them in making that goal happen. So the degree to which an instructional coach models that approach with a staff, it becomes similar to the staff carrying that role out with the student. So that if you're going to see the student in a more empowered role, I need to see the teacher in a more empowered role. So in effect, the coach is working for the teacher the same way the teacher wants to be working for the students.
Which gets back to your culture.
Yep. Yep.
What else do people need to know about your approach to coaching?
I guess the thing to know about my approach is that it's not giving you the model to implement, but looking at the skills and processes you want to use in whatever model it is you're working with. And what my encouragement would be is for coaches to look at each other's to look at various models. I'm frequently surprised people will talk to me that they've been working with you or working with one of the other people who develop coaching, and there's this kind of they're waiting to see that I've got some resistance to that, as if. You can't do one person's model if you're going to do the other person's model. And I think getting people to just think much broader, that uh, that There's something in each of these techniques and strategies that fit with different teachers I'm working with, much the same way as a teacher I'm trying to achieve goals with kids, I need a different set of strategies. And so how do you develop your skill base as a coach so that you can switch to be what the person you're working with needs you to be at that moment?
Yeah, that's a good one.
If you need me to be the expert role, I'll step into the expert role to help you here. I won't hold back just because that's not the model we're using. But if I can tell you want to be more cognitive about this and you're likely to go further with it that way, I'll step in. Because my goal is for you to achieve your goal with the students, not to be married to the model that I'm implementing.
The only thing I would add to that is there are skills with each of those. Like we talk about facilitative dialogue.
Yes.
Directive.
Yes.
If I'm going to share expertise around effective instruction, then I need that expertise.
Yes.
If I'm going to be a facilitative coach, then there's a set of questions and there's a mindset and what Christian calls a way of being that goes with that. You know, so if I'm going to be directive, that brings its own challenges. I think if I'm going to be a directive, I got to be careful about when I do that and realize when it's the appropriate. Because in most cases, I think you can do it. You can accomplish what a directive coach does, but come at it from the partnership perspective, where you position the person as a decision maker.
I'm totally on with you that there's different skill sets to each of them.
Right. So I just retyped my question here. So it's up to date now. So since our conference theme is courage, please tell me a bit about how you see courage as a part of coaching, or how you see courage manifested in coaching, or how courage relates to coaching.
Well, the word that connects for me, which is the one that I write and speak about most often, is vulnerability. So And the big word that people are always putting out front is that you have to have trust. You have to build trust. And my issue back is you can't get trust until someone makes him or herself vulnerable. So if you're looking at developing a coaching relationship, somehow as coach, I need to make myself vulnerable to you. And if you go back to your comments about modeling, if I'm willing to step in and model something in your classroom where I don't have everything set up and laid out and planned the way that I can direct it, I see that as a step into vulnerability. I see the teacher opening the door to a coach that she doesn't know or hasn't worked with as a step into vulnerability. So I guess I would label that courage is what allows you to step into that vulnerable role. I did quite a bit of work in districts in Iowa as they're implementing their teacher leadership piece. And I've said frequently that part of what makes you a teacher leader is that you're willing to make yourself vulnerable before the safe environment's been built, before the trust has been built. And because of your vulnerability, quote, because of your courage, now we have the chance for the necessary environment to be built.
It's kind of the courage to be vulnerable then.
Yeah, that's where the courage comes. And the payoff is that it creates that opportunity for trust to be built.
So our last question is, please give us a quick summary of what you'll present at TLC.
Well, I'm hoping, Jim, that I could work in two areas that are key for me. One being the rollout of that backwards plan, and how do I take people through a backwards plan, whether I'm working with an individual teacher in that one-on-one coaching setting, or working with a larger group in a professional learning community setting, and how coaching ties into that. And the other that I'd be happy to work with is my work with questioning and applying that critical thinking process to the coaching process. That sound good?
I think it's awesome, and I'm very grateful you're coming. I think it's, and I'm glad we'll get to talk a little bit. I'm thrilled. I'm looking forward. This conversation's way too short.
I'd like to see you and I make a commitment to at least do this three or four times a year. Just get together like this and have the conversation, have it recorded. I think it would be valuable for, I know it would be valuable for me. And I think it would be to a lot of people who get a chance to listen to us.
I'd love it. And I think that it could be like a point counterpoint, kind of like there's points where there's a Venn diagram.
Yeah.
And it's not that we disagree, but we see things from different vantage points.
That's the value of it.
For example, you could teach me so much about peer coaching, which I'm very interested in, and your experiences. And I cite you all the time, the idea of the principal saying, I just taught a class and I recorded it on video and now my coach is going to coach me. That resonates. Like those kind of ideas are super valuable to hear from each other. So I think a chance to learn would be wonderful. I love it.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks a lot, Jim.
Hey, Steve, thank you so much. I'm looking forward to seeing you.
Great. I look forward to it.
All right. Take care.
Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening, folks. I'd love to hear what you're pondering. You can find me on Twitter at Steve Barkley or send me your questions and find my videos and blogs at barkleypd.com.